You're listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast from the Modern War Institute at West Point. I'm John Spencer, Chair of Urban Warfare Studies at MWI and host of this podcast. Today's guest on the podcast is Stuart Lyle, Urban Operations Research Lead for the UK-based Defense Science and Technologies Laboratory, DSTL, and Major Jason Giroux, an infantry officer with the Royal Canadian Regiment and currently with the Canadian Army Doctrine Training Center. Of course, if you've ever listened to the show, these are my closest friends, fellow urban scholars, fellow world-leading urban warfare scholars. And this is our annual Christmas wish list episode. I am almost dating myself, guys, or I look back and we started these, if not before 2021, I found the 2021 episode. Every year, getting together, people who have studied urban operations, now if you take all of our ages together, collectively over three decades, I know Jason's way older than that, but let's just say liberally three decades of research, what do we see watching all the warfare, watching all the military, since we're multinational, we have British representation, we have Canadian, we have US, we have, of course, study of everybody's. So that's great. But what do we wish for next year, whether it's a piece of technology, an initiative, it doesn't matter. If you look back at our, I used to put some restrictions on it, but this year it's a little more freer. We haven't gotten back together in a while, but there's definitely been a lot of urban warfare in the last year, let alone last 3 years. I would say it is the dominant character of warfare today and into the future. Guys, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, I cut myself off there because I'm so excited to talk about my wish list and hope that it comes true next year. So thanks, guys. I'll hand it off to each of you. As the sometimes referenced as the godfather of urban warfare operations, that my two friends love that people say that wasn't me. You can I think it was General Woolridge that continued it onto written form and in the podcast series, but that's an aside. John Spencer's urban warfare wish list number one, Christmas wish list that I wish Santa would bring, is just one, and actually I'll show you why. One transformational senior leader that understands urban warfare is not the future, the present. Doesn't matter what theater of operations you look at, the present dominant terrain, the decisive terrain of warfare and wars, and is willing to put resources and time, money, effort to follow that up. Not only believe it, but then take action. And the story that I will tell is that in our 2021 episode of This Christmas List, I said that the United States military does not have a single urban operations course. Yes, they have tactical courses and they have some things in the special community. We have a jungle school in the 25th ID. We have Arctic school. We have schools for every environment, but not urban. One transformational leader, and I said it could be any division because there has been divisions like the 25th ID with restarting the jungle operations program, divisions, the 10th Mountain at one point had started an urban warfare platoon level course, but it was still something. And it closed again when leaders change out, but it doesn't have to be like the four star, although I've worked for four stars back in 2014. Later with General Odinero, and then later with General Milley, who understood and gave speeches about the future, the present is urban operations. We have to optimize for it. It will be where the decisive battles are at. But during this episode of the Christmas wish list, I made the point that we don't have a school. I wish one leader, one division. And then I had a division, a deputy commander of a division, General Rob Woolridge, reached out to me and say, I believe with the urbanization, population growth, everything. And this is before Ukraine, say that I want to do this. And we created, along with Stuart, and Jason, we helped develop a POI, and using the 40th Infantry Division, California Army National Guard, resources, location, leadership, created the world's only urban operations planner course for oriented at brigades and divisions on how to conduct large-scale combat operations in urban terrain. And we ran it for 4 years. Every year we learned something, we developed it. And then General Woolrich was not, basically had to retire, and the course went away. Even though it was a very small fraction of amount of money, he was the transformational leader that we don't have today, in John Spencer's personal opinion, that we don't have today, that believes in it and will put resources and action it and create something that would have military-wide value. That's John Spencer's first wish list. I'll hand it over to Jason, I think.
Well, thanks, John. Excuse me. I just want to thank you again, John, for having me back. This is my 7th Urban Warfare Project podcast, and I want to thank Stu for joining us as well. And, you know, it's great, John, what you said earlier, that, you know, you're an American urban operations researcher and writer. Stu is an Irish urban operations defense scientist with the British Army. I'm a Canadian urban warfare historian of the Canadian Armed Forces. So we attack this problem of urban operations from different angles and experiences and contexts. So we hope to give you, the listeners, another good show today. We hope to top the ones from 2021, 2023, and 2024, and that you walk away having learned something. So my first wish, it's a somewhat controversial one, but it's one that John and I have actually discussed before. We need to rethink the legalities and begin using tear gas or CS gas in urban operations again. So back on the 2nd of August, 2024, John, Stu, and I did an Urban Warfare Project podcast on urban strong points. And around the 36-minute mark, John and I moved into a discussion on the use of tear gas and flamethrowers in urban operations. But I want to talk about tear gas in particular. Now, this is going to make some of our listeners bristle, but John and I are supportive of using CS gas in urban operations. Now, we understand that CS gas is now considered a weapon that falls within the chemical, biological, radioactive, nuclear, or CBRN category, and that its use is prohibited unless you have very high levels of authorization. And if I recall correctly, and John, if you can verify, please, I believe you said during that podcast that the U.S. military can use CS gas due to the terms of the Riot Control Agent Act. It's been ratified by the Senate. And if the President of the United States can authorize it, is that correct, John? Yeah.
Yes. So the Senate, so you're talking about the it's not prohibited in the use in war. Some countries have signed a riot control agent prohibition. Like you said, the United States Senate ratified it. The president signed it with exclusion, actually. He has the right to say, but I can determine if we go to war. And actually, in the opening of the Iraq War, President Bush signed that. I didn't know that as a soldier. So to say it's prohibited is not accurate. Right now, the U.S. military, under the prohibition, although the president, like in the Iraq War, kind of said, I'm taking the exclusion that's built into this and saying, no, we can use it as a form of warfare. You're right that under even that restriction, it can be used in like by military police in a riot control or prison kind of scenario. That's what I was saying. But it's definitely a detailed, nuanced conversation.
Right. And I think I also remember you saying, John, that it can be used in a defensive context to save lives, right? So
as you know, in creating the 40th Infantry Division Urban Operations Planners course, I would push our friend Colonel Blanco to like, okay, where can you use it? Where can't you use it? And it's nuanced, but this is the court of public opinion who believes that CS is considered NBC. It's not, or riot control, tear gas. It's not, and it's not prohibited. I mean, there's very, you know, it's a nuanced conversation as much as the flamethrower is on, okay, what does it say specific to the country? And like you said, okay, when can you use it? When can't you use it? And the main restriction is on as a form of warfare. And I think that would really get to your I know that you and I agree, and we've shown in case studies like the Battle of Wei and others, I don't want to steal your thunder, that it has successfully been used even in current times like the Battle of Morori, effectively clear buildings. But go ahead.
Yeah, okay. So I think we agree there's some tricky legal issues to negotiate here. And it's not unlawful, but it does require a very high authority to prove its use. And this is understandable because as the argument goes, that if you use something like tear gas, you then begin to slide down a slippery slope. And there's the possibility that things will escalate and other quite lethal CBRN weapons are then brought into the fight to be used. And that's an understandable argument, although there's a certain irony that while militaries are heavily restricted in the use of CS gas in times of war, our domestic police forces can use them on our citizens during domestic events, although its use there is also restricted. And there's no chance of anything escalating in that context because our domestic police forces don't have any lethal CBRN weapons in their inventory. However, here's where I put my urban warfare historian's hat on. There is historical precedent of the successful use of tear gas in urban operations. John just mentioned a couple, and I'm going to mention them too. John and I aren't just throwing this out there to be deliberately controversial, but to demonstrate it's been used successfully in the past. So the Battle of Hue in South Vietnam, 1968, 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines used tear gas at the Treasury Building in New Hue, and 1st Battalion, 5th Marines also used it in the Citadel in Old Hue. And the Battle of Morawi, Philippines, in 2017, when the Armed Forces of the Philippines used it against Islamic State insurgents in the Vanilla House, the Avocado House, the Bato Mosque, and then finally the Constriction Area in East Morawi. And by the way, John participated in a Modern War Institute panel at West Point Military Academy that you can find on YouTube entitled MWI War Council Fighting Terrorism in the City of the Battle of Morawi, where Lieutenant General Daniel Pamanag, who commanded all the armed forces of the Philippine Special Forces during the battle, spoke about the battle itself and their use of tear gas. So when you review these historical cases, you can see that there are both negatives and positives to the use of CS gas. The negatives we've already discussed. The slippery slope into the use of lethal CBRN weapons, got it. But then again, we do have very high authorities for its use, and as long as militaries can enable a high level of self-discipline, and yes, it's understood that some militaries fail at that, then we can assume that risk. However, let's look at the positives. Many of our adversaries are not capable of fighting in a CBRN environment because they do not have the gas masks and the other equipment. So instead of using munitions, whose explosive power can cause civilian casualties, and or cause the destruction of buildings, making it difficult for our military personnel, because not only does civilian casualties cause justifiable international outrage, it also causes a negative psychological effect on our military personnel because they cause those civilian casualties. And the physical destruction of buildings and subterranean systems causes large amounts of rubble that must be overcome by friendly forces. However, tear gas does not have those violent and physically destructive effects. Once it's breathed in, our adversaries become nauseous, they have difficulty breathing, they begin vomiting. If it's delivered in high doses, they become physically incapacitated due to the gas's effect. Now, if they remain within a heavy gas environment, they could die. That's understood. So the use of gas and the forward movement of friendly forces has to be synchronized so that our adversaries and our civilians that do become incapacitated can be removed to safety. But the use of CS gas now gives friendly forces the ability to close with and eliminate those adversary positions, or at least force the adversary to withdraw from those positions. Now they're giving up urban terrain. So the use of tear gas can be a non-lethal means of defeating the enemy without the use of violence. So if there's a choice between eliminating the adversary's fighting positions and causing less collateral damage by using measurable amounts of CS gas rather than using munitions, then arguably CS gas is the way to go. And if there's still any doubters, let's go back to that case study on Hue that John and I wrote for the Modern War Institute's Urban Warfare Project, where we used an excerpt from 1st Battalion, 5th Marines After Action Review. And I want you to listen to these numbers, folks. During 1-5's battle inside the Citadel Fortress, which kicked off on 13 February 1968, the battalion progressed a total of 4 blocks along our avenue of attack and had secured a total of 16 city blocks within our assigned area of operations after nearly 2 weeks of heavy street fighting and after suffering nearly 50% casualties at the hands of a well-prepared, determined force of North Vietnamese Army soldiers. On 25 February 1968, Marines from Charlie Company shot off 3 E-8 gas launchers, each carrying about 40 CS gas grenades towards the enemy's last known position. The next morning, 1-5 took control of the remaining 12 city blocks in about 3 hours without a single casualty because the North Vietnamese Army was not equipped to deal with the tear gas attack and was forced to withdraw. No one can ever be certain that the use of chemical weapons would have made a difference in the initial stages of the battle, although we were all issued new gas masks the day before we went into Hue City. But many of the veterans of that battle have often wondered what might have happened if the E-8s had been deployed in the early stages of the battle. We recommend the judicious use of chemical weapons such as tear gas, etc., for urban combat operations. That's that AAR from 1-5. Now, that date of 25 February is somewhat questionable there because I know that 1-5 was wrapping things up on that day. But let's look at those numbers regardless. Without the use of tear gas and using munitions, it took the Marines 2 weeks to clear 16 city blocks with 50% casualties. With the use of tear gas, it took the Marines 3 hours to clear 12 city blocks with 0% casualties. This historical example certainly, I think, solidifies the argument that CS gas, if it's used judiciously and with discipline, can be and indeed must be used in urban operations. So my first wish is to see the legal discussion that's required in order to return the use of CS gas within urban warfare. And now that I've thrown that gas grenade into the room, pun intended, John, John, I know your opinion, but Stu, I'm curious as to what your opinions are on this particular wish as well.
So when I teach urban operations, one of the things that I do raise is some of the absolutes that people seem to think about urban operations, and one of them is around legalities of certain issues, and CS gas is one of the things that does get brought up because people do read about Hue. Less about Marawi, but I also teach a case study on Marawi as well. So some people do know about it. But one of the things that I do try and say in that particular lesson is I say, I understand how military bridging works. I understand the mechanics of it. I wouldn't tell an engineer where to place a bridge. So when people start talking about in very absolute terms, about the legality of certain aspects, without having spoken to a military legad, and even when, as John hinted there, when you do speak to a military legad, you don't necessarily always get a clear answer either. So, I'm always very cautious about making any absolute statements about legality or illegality on anything until I've spoken to a legad. So I'm gonna sit on the fence and say this isn't my wheelhouse. I'm gonna abscond. Sorry.
So. Just real quickly for me is I've gone down the history, right, of where did the conversation, there was a giant U.S. Senate debate after Vietnam and how tear gas was being used, not in Hue, but in, especially with the tunnels and things like that. And I went down this research agenda, basically researching it, and it's deep, but I appreciate the wish list because it is a policy issue. It's not anything other than that, because it's not a legal issue. It's a policy issue, which is sometimes hard for people to understand. There's no giant law of war restriction. It's very nuanced, and it becomes across what we call the .mil PF spectrum. And like I said, most people in the force didn't know that George Bush had enacted the exclusion saying, yes, you can use it. And for all the reasons, it's a nuanced conversation. Thank you, Jason. Stu, over to you.
Well, and just as I say, thanks again for having us on the show, John. You mentioned the 40th ID course, and it's late in the UK. One of the reasons why it's late in the UK is because I had to postpone the recording of this so that I could go to the cinema and see Die Hard on the big screen. And the reason I bring that up is because when I was last at the 40th ID Urban Ops Planners course, I got to actually visit Nakatomi Tower and actually see the real location. So I was watching it this evening and thinking back to being in LA with you guys and teaching on the course. It also neatly leads on to my first wish. So there's a bit of context required here. First of all, we are in a slightly better position in the UK than what you outlined for the US. We have a little bit more momentum behind urban operations. It is a topic that does come up regularly at unit level in the various professional military education circles. We do have those courses we have the urban operations instructors course, which is teaching NCOs and junior officers up to sort of company level actions in the tactical level. But then we're also now starting to gain momentum at the higher levels as well. So we have an urban center within within the UK. It's a British Army institution, and they will be running the first UK version of the Urban Operations Planners course in March. And then we're hope it's going to be UK only, but we're going to hopefully then make it international, following the same, learning the lessons from what the 40th ID developed for the US Army. And we're going to try and generate that on the European side. Now, the next thing that comes from that is that we have recently announced that the UK is going to seek to create and get validated for a NATO Centre of Excellence for Urban Operations, which was previously one of my wishes in a previous incarnation of this.
Yeah.
So in that regard, that's a positive thing. You know, Santa has come and visited and has dropped that one off. Now, I have been working with the military now for quite some time. You guys are the same. You get a level of cynicism. There's a level of cautious optimism around these sorts of things. So for me, my first Christmas wish list is that there will be follow through on that, and that we will then see from the UK side, we're going to get that dynamic leadership that's going to push it through, that's going to allocate the funding. We're going to then get the staffing levels, the accreditation. We're going to get on side with NATO, and everything's going to get signed off. And we're going to have this glorious institution that we've all been calling for a very long time. And it's going to be awesome. So that's my first wish this year, is that we will then take that, pick up the ball and run with it. And we're going to get that follow through.
Okay, so I have questions.
Okay, go for it.
So starting with the British Army Urban Operations Center, is that a building and how many people?
So it's been an iterative process building momentum for the last 3 years now. So initially it was a small number of military personnel and some contractors who were then brought in to run specific training events. So they would run training war games. They would run, deliver lectures at professional military education sites, that sort of thing. But they've also been trying to cohere UK doctrine, make sure that they're identify if there's any gaps in the doctrine and where they might have to put some effort in and fill that gap, which is part of the ongoing activities they're doing at the moment. It has been surging in terms of the level of demand over the last 3 years that we've had. We started out with two military people, then dropped down to one. It was gapped for a while where we didn't have any military, and it was just contractors. We now have a major who is filling that role in the military side, and we still have the contractors. So that's where we currently sit with the Urban Center. And it's been something that's been going on for now, I'd say 3 years. There is no current indication that it's going to disappear anytime soon.
I ask about it because it's been on my past wish list as well, for the U.S. military to have an urban operations center, not a for research and everything. Actually, it's been an NDA, our NDA twice, and I knew from, of course, visiting you and everything, how it had gone down to like one person, and that person needed to rotate out for his career. I know there's lots of challenges. Now, on your wish list, the NATO Center of Excellence, you're right, and that actually predates even the start of my urban warfare research in 2014 as the NATO urbanization study, I forget what it was called, but I had David Kilcullen and a bunch of other friends that it was a 5-year study program that recommended a center and to keep it going. I would love to see that. Also would love to see the budget line for that too. So it's actually a faculty, not a rotating thing. Okay. And I know I could see, I can't see Jason, but I can just see him twitching a little bit that he might not get a third wish on our Christmas list. So I'll try to be more succinct on my second wish list. So my second wish list, after having visited some, let's say, U.S. military units recently and watching, especially the Modern War Institute, I mean, like every week, you know, drones are a big part of the conversation. Of course, in my research in Ukraine, Nagorno-Karabakh, a lot lately, Gaza, drones are there. But my Gaza experience is really, if we're talking about urban warfare, how they, the IDF, one of the most technologically advanced militaries, and having things that other militaries that are expeditionary wouldn't at the moment, went into Gaza, the greatest urban warfare challenges that a military has faced in this generation almost, without drones. Drones that were, I had just seen in Ukraine, totally available, or ISIS had in 2014 in the Battle of Mosul. Like, they're not new. They're actually 30 plus years old by this point, 20 years on the battlefield, and especially the last 5 years, just dominating. So John Spencer's second wish list is a mandate from the U.S. military that no soldier in urban warfare goes down a street, enters a room, turns an alley without a drone in front of it. And I think that mandate would force all the challenges that are currently faced, because like the units in Gaza that I saw, especially in early in 2023 or late 2023, early 2024, were scrambling to order off-the-shelf drones to be able to do that. They evolved that tactic. I don't see the U.S. military for a whole host of reasons, but, you know, like we've talked in the past on many of our podcasts, is that if the enemy knows you're there, you're not going to be stacking on outside of exterior doors and going through, you know, exterior walls and going through doors. There are other, and I know Jason, Mouseholing, Ortona, others, but at this point in of our development, there is not a single reason that any soldier should be entering a room with an unknown factor, and he's lost surprise. So the whole evolution of the close quarters battles or battle drill six are not the same thing. Enter and clear a room, and I've written that paper on the evolution of that. Today, there is no reason why a mandate could not force every, especially U.S. military, infantry squad, platoon, company, battalion, to have a drone in front of them in urban warfare, a cheap, expendable drone, because yes, we have it available, but we don't have the mandate that there should be no leading with your face, as my former boss, General Rainey, said today. You should not be stacking on the outside of doors if the enemy knows you're there, as in like you did some preparatory fire or any reason. And in all of the urban warfare that I'm going out and researching, that's what's happening. They're not leading with their face. They've made the doctrinal, task organizational equipment changes so they can put a drone in front of them, if not to have lethal capability, just at least to not to go into a surprise or to turn a corner, because of all those higher level drones are not as useful in the close urban fight. And I think a mandate from the Department of War would be very impactful to force the changes that I don't see in urban warfare. And we're still doing things like stacking on doors, which is a separate conversation. That's my simple, but I think would have a complete military-wide change for the better. Okay, over to you, Jason.
All right. My second wish, militaries to use actual cities for urban operations, training exercises without troops, TEWTs, the cute pronunciation of toots, for battalion and division-level exercise planning, combined with a war game in the same area. Most militaries believe that urban operations training is just the small unit exercises, the stacking, the room clearing, the walking down hallways, the hands and feet skills. However, we all know that's just half of it. The other half is teaching officers and very senior NCOs how to do the planning, tactics, and sustainment at the company, battalion, brigade, division, corps levels. You can't get your troops clearing rooms and buildings and sub-training systems unless you know how to get your troops to the rooms and the buildings and the sub-D systems in the first place. So either you have to run an urban operations planning course for higher ranks, or you have to do some lectures. I know a guy who can do that, by the way.
I know a whole team.
Yeah, and get those officers, senior NCOs, to do toots in actual cities, not military urban operations training areas, but actual cities. Now, there might be a reluctance to do a toot in a city. It's easier to do it in a military urban operations training area because you have less hoops to jump through, less paperwork, less work, less coordination, less liaison. The problem with military training urban areas are often they're often too sanitized and too clean, and the buildings are too spaced out. There's no collateral damage, and they're not big enough for battalion or brigade or division level planning. So when John, Stu, and I were on the Urban Ops Planners course down in Los Angeles, we traveled to the U.S. Military's National Training Center in Fort Irwin, and we visited their Razish Urban Operations Training Site. And yes, they do brigade level exercises there. Great experience. Learned a lot from the staff who do the urban operations exercises there. But even they admitted that these exercises at Razish in particular, and with urban operations in general, are usually like the urban operation. It's the last activity of a week-long exercise. The whole exercise is not just focused solely on the urban environment. It's the last part of the exercise, and they just want to get it over and done with. Everybody's tired and exhausted. So the urban operations training area has very little to no sub-training systems, and they can't simulate large civilian populations, and they can't simulate weapons effects on buildings. So in order to really understand the urban quad, and that's the urban terrain, the actual physical buildings and sub-training systems, the urban infrastructure, which is all the people and facilities that make a city work, the population and the information systems within that urban quad within the urban environment, it's better to do an exercise in an actual city. But you can't have tanks and troopies running around an actual city shooting at stuff. So toots are the next best thing. But even then, there's that reluctance to put in the effort. Human beings are inherently lazy. So, you know, the more hoops you have to jump through and the more paperwork and the more work coordination liaison, you need to have the proper authorization. Sometimes you don't want to be out in public in uniform. You don't want to attract the attention. You don't want to unnerve the local population when you have a soldier in uniform going, "I'm going to put a machine gun in that building right there," and they don't know why you're there doing that. But I'm telling you, if you do these tactical exercises without troops in an actual city, the effort and the results are just fantastic. So for that Urban Operations Planners course, General Wooldridge had himself, John, Stu, and I flying around UH-60 Blackhawks as flying classrooms. We were flying over Los Angeles, and we were looking at all the different urban terrain zones, which is absolutely fantastic. But we even went a step further. We actually did a toot down in Long Beach. We were on top of a hotel roof. We had issued operational orders. The students had to take those operational orders, all the products that were created, and they actually had to think about how to do offensive or defensive in a dense urban area, and Long Beach was exactly that. When I was with the tactics school, we had a couple of courses where I'd take them down into downtown Fredericton, and we would do toots down there, walk around the city. I'd get up onto rooftops, and we would look around. Fantastic. When I was in Toronto, with the 40th Highlanders, the ex-Urban Falcon, we were using sub-training systems for force on force, but then I had the officers and senior NCOs using the surface, the super surface, and the subsurface to do these toots. And Stu, from what I understand, the British Army's just purchased a large urban training area. I'm just wondering, is that going to be used for force on force or toots or a little bit of both?
So what I think you're referring to is the Infantry Battle School runs our Urban Operations Instructors course. And it's a 3-week course, specifically for the middle week where they are building up to platoon level, but then also includes the defensive aspects. We're finding that the training areas that they were using, the military training areas that they were using, were too small to do mobile urban defense, to do it to any sort of credible level. So the team there did a fantastic job and actually located it's a disused industrial unit on the side of a medium sized city. So you've got that kind of background clutter, the EMS clutter. You've got the considerations of canalized movement to the training area, to the actual area where you're going to then do your kinetic actions. But they can use blank and pyrotechnics. So they can also then do force on force exercises, so it's not strictly a toot. So they can actually do. So we refer to that as we call it TOPL. So TOPL, training on private land, is sort of the generic sort of catch-all term for it. But it's finding those real-world locations where actually you can go out and you can start, you know, using blank ammunition. You can start moving some level of vehicles around. Obviously, you know, driving a tank around is probably taking it a bit too far. But you can start to then, you know, maneuver through more complex terrain. The buildings have clutter inside them. They actually have windows, which, you know, from a defensive perspective, actually, you know, can be quite important because they, you know, that blocks you from things like thermal optics being able to identify where your positions are, and things like that. So you can start to tease out some of those lessons. So definitely, well, yeah, it's definitely worth the squeeze if you get over the hurdle of the administrative burden of getting it permissions and finding the right location. But once you've done it, the benefits are tremendous.
Good, cool. So anyway, the great things about these toots is that you're getting officers and senior NCOs at the company, battalion, brigade, division, corps levels out there actually walking in real dense, cluttered urban terrain. They're seeing the subterranean systems. They're seeing the complexity. You can discuss weapons effects. You can simulate collateral damage, or at least get a feeling as to how much collateral damage will actually be. They'll see the challenges of logistics. So you just get a greater appreciation for the planning, tactics, and sustainment of an offensive or defensive urban operation, because you're seeing the urban quad up close and personal. And then what I'll suggest, if you really want to put in the effort, after the syndicates have created their cunning offensive or defensive urban operations plans in whatever city you're doing the toot in, you create an urban war game. So now that you can simulate the actual operation, so now you can understand the challenges to simulate the collateral damage and the weapons effects, the effects on the civilian population, because urban war games are pretty good at doing that. So stop thinking that urban operations is all about clearing rooms and buildings, leading with your face, as John said. It's not. It's also about getting our officers and very senior NCOs prepared for urban operations planning, tactics, sustainment at the higher levels also. And they can only do that if they're in an actual city, not a military urban operations training area. Put the effort in and conduct urban operations toots. And that's my second wish, John.
All right. Although I would love to hear you just continue to say toot, and I don't accept Stu's newer word for it. We want to get over to Stu.
All right. Cheers. I completely agree with what Jason said. Get out into that real world terrain, walk the ground, just have those discussions, etc. But I also feel that there is still a role for those military training sites where you can drive an armored vehicle down the road, where you can fire blank, where you can throw practice grenades, and that sort of thing. And certainly where you can then instrument them, the buildings, the soldiers themselves, and actually start to show some of these weapon effects as well, and actually illustrate to troops what the weapon effects can do. Which is something that instrumentation can absolutely do. So my second wish would be to have more medium-sized urban training areas. We all get glassy-eyed and we want to sort of put on the wish list for all those big urban training sites, you know, the Range 220s, the Rasesh, Senzu for the French, the Schnorgersberg.
Snazberg, yeah.
Yeah, for the Germans. Those are really impressive locations. I'm not taking away from them. They are really impressive locations. But it's a single location, which means that it's difficult for troops from, you know, the four corners of any country to get to. It becomes an all-consuming effort to do that. And there's also usually this effort. Even we find it even with our smaller urban training site, you know, the largest one we've got is Coupil Down. And even within that, if your unit turns up, you might still have to share that location, even though it's not a particularly big location. You still might only have access to one quarter of it, or at most half of it. So there'd be multiple units operating concurrently in the same, albeit small, urban training area. And that's simply because we just don't have enough of them. So if we had more medium scale urban training areas, they could be dispersed around the country. It gives multiple units, no matter where they're based, more opportunities to get to them. You might, if there are more opportunities, you might get the entire urban area to train in, not just part of one, because we're not trying to, you know, get everybody through the same things. And then the other benefit is that you could then start to then have each of the locations represent a specific urban terrain zone. And this is one of the things we find with places like Senzub is a classic example of this, where they've tried to replicate multiple urban terrain zones within the same training area. And what ends up happening is you get a little bit of residential, you get a little bit of industrial, you get a little bit of high rise. But it's not, it doesn't feel very natural. It doesn't look right, because you don't tend to get them in these tiny little postage stamp size locations that are then sort of jutting out against others. So it feels very forced. It feels very artificial, adding to the kind of the disconnect between, you know, the fact that there's no civilians and there's no ground clutter, that sort of stuff. So I would have multiple medium scale urban training areas dotted around the country, and each one of them focusing on a single urban terrain zone. So have one that is just light industrial, light to medium industrial. Have one that is just high-rise residential. Have one that is just inner city core, etc. And if you've got that, then actually, rather than trying to get permission and the budgets for one very large location with all the instrumentation, the gold-plated version, that's going to be much harder to try and justify. Whereas, you know, over the long term, try and think strategically, try and think long term and say, well, actually, let's try and get justification for and the budget for this urban terrain zone with the instrumentation and get it built, and then move on to the next one and the next one and the next one. We've started to see it at the in the UK at the very lowest level. So we've got we're starting to build some of the low level skills facilities. So I know you've had Rob Taylor from 4GD on the podcast before. The British Army has bought a number and is building a number of the urban skills facilities. They're going to be scattered around the UK. So units from different locations are going to get access to that. And that's going to build up those sort of the individual, the section, up to platoon level individuals, hands and feet stuff, the skills that Jason talked about. If we can replicate the same intent with those medium sized locations, then now we can start to build onto platoon and then company level, doing the hands and feet stuff. Couple that with Toots, which are going to be training the kind of the battalion, the battle group level, the brigade level staff, we're onto a winner, really. And we can really sort of nail this one down. So that's my not focusing on building another large scale urban training site. Focusing on multiple medium scale.
Got it. I think that's a great one. And I agree with you, whether it's Muscatatuck that we have here that has all the functional areas, which is great, but you're right, it just feels forced. Even Sehalim in Israel, which is the big IDF one and National Training Center, it also has different regions reflected in segments of it. You're right. And I can't say enough about Rob's episode. Go back and listen to that, because of what I saw at that training site, the 4GD capability to train the leadership, not necessarily the hands and feet that Jason talked about, but the actual platoon leaders and other leaders ability to use the enablers like the drone that I'm talking about into their actual training so that they train as they fight. 4GD in the demonstration, I think I saw, or was it the 16th pair or something, that allows for all those enablers to be integrated into the physical. So it's the live virtual constructive that everybody talks about. The 4GD has it. And I know that there's more, the British military has a lot of access to them. And I wish other militaries did as well. Okay. So that I don't come off of Jason Giroux's Christmas list, I have to get a third wish in, but I'm going to put a 2-minute restriction on it, Jason, just so you can't complain to me for another year that you didn't get your third wish. So my third wish that I will do in less than 2 minutes is real-time mapping of urban terrain using artificial intelligence. I was talking in 2014, we had it as part of our strategic studies group finding that it's needed. Nobody has it. The technology wasn't there. I've seen it demonstrated in Gaza. The IDF have integrated real-time mapping with artificial intelligence because of the rubble, the IEDs, the threats that change minute by minute, hour to hour. The platoon leaders, commanders, everybody has using multiple forms of intelligence, drones, satellites, everything, overflights the morning before, an AI generated 3D map before he steps one foot into the lane in which he's about to walk or anything. I want that capability for all militaries, real-time mapping. Jason, over to you with that constraint.
Okay. You know what, John? I'm going to build on that. I would like to see what else AI can do on other aspects of the urban battlefield. So my third wish is somebody out there who's really SMRT smart and who can figure that out. Like our friend Anthony King, his second edition of Urban Warfare in the 21st Century is now out. He wrote a chapter in our good friend John Sullivan and his colleagues Nathan Jones and Daniel Argomito's Urban Operations, War Crime and Conflict. Tony wrote a chapter about AI in urban operations, but that it could be used for the intelligence preparation of the operational environment, the IPOE, within the urban environment. And I can tell you, after rewriting the Canadian Urban Operations Doctrinal publication and the chapter on IPOE in particular with my good friend Major Colin Papashak, who's a military intelligence officer with the Canadian Armed Forces, he's been very passionate about the IPOE in the urban environment for a few years now. And wow, when it comes to the complexities of the urban quad, there's just laundry lists of information that have to be gathered and analyzed before an urban warfare battle can occur. So, I mean, if you want to look back in urban warfare history, I think the Americans did IPOE really well when preparing for the Second Battle of Fallujah in November, December 2004. But they took months and months to do a really good IPOE of that city, and sometimes militaries may not have that kind of time. So I think Tony is right. AI can be great for IPOE in the urban environment, not only because it'll be able to do the information gathering analysis, but to be able to do it quicker. But what I'm interested in is seeing is what AI can do in other aspects of urban operations planning and warfare. John, you just mentioned it's being incorporated into UAVs. Can it be incorporated in the targeting process? Where can AI be used, not just in the planning, but in the execution and the post-battle phases? So, you know, I routinely do urban operations professional development lectures for militaries around the world, and I'm always receiving two questions in particular now. How are UAVs affecting the urban battlefield, and how is AI used in urban warfare? The first question I can answer easily. The second one I can only state that it can be used for IPO of the urban environment, but there has to be more, really. And so my second wish is for somebody to get me smart on AI in urban operations, other aspects besides the IPOE. That's my third wish, John.
All right. We should talk. It is being used for targeting, and which is massive. And we taught this in the 40th Infantry Division for civilian harm mitigation, the ability to use all forms of intelligence rapidly to have an awareness of the presence of civilians and other things that are overwhelming, depending on the scale, density, all that through urban operations. Stu, over to you.
Okay. So this is pretty much similar to one that I asked for in a previous episode, but it's something that is a recurring theme and it's just been sort of compounded upon. So what I would like to see is the unique characteristics of operating in an urban environment reflected in the development of military equipment. So we see this time and again, where throughout history, but even, you know, sort of modern procurement, where we procure a piece of kit, it's entirely designed to fight in a rural space, and then we suddenly thrust it into an urban space and are told to sort of, well, make do. Or, you know, in a sort of modern procurement, if it hasn't been used in an urban area, as we're in my role within my organization, we then are doing some of the analysis and testing, the operational analysis on the concepts before they then get procured. And again, you know, vehicles or equipment that is then put to us to then test, we'll put it into an urban area. And again, you know, this, you can almost copy and paste some of the recommendations, because, you know, the unique features of operating in that urban canyon, with, you know, making simple things like what are the turning circles on vehicles? You know, how much of the vehicle do you need to expose before you can bring a weapon system to bear down a side street? Those sorts of considerations are not really baked into an awful lot of the modern platforms that are being procured. I've had the chance to speak to some of the large defense primes and some of their concept teams who sort of come up with some of the next generation of kit and equipment. And they're not thinking about urban operations at all. And there's a bit of a chicken and egg thing here. The militaries aren't asking for it. They're not thinking about it. And at some point then it sort of butts up against either organizations like mine in the testing phase or the reality that once you've procured something, chances are at some point it's going to end up in an urban area and you're going to be there trying to, you know, sort of do a 3-point turn in a vehicle that has the turning circle of an oil tanker. And that's a very tricky place to be when you're in contact with the enemy. So these sorts of the unique characteristics of operating in that urban environment, it's pretty common. It's not something that people can sort of wish away. So I would like to see those characteristics baked into platform design from the outset, so that it isn't just a kind of make do as best you can in the future. It's actually, we've thought about this because actually this is something we tend to do on a fairly frequent basis. So, you know, it would be nice to be prepared for it.
Actually, if you take all three of our first wishes, the outputs of those would be, I think, some of our other wishes, that if you had a center, or you had one leader, you had a center that could do not just the training, education, but also advise on the research and development. You just bring up, I saw this Palmer Luckey, you know, Anduril's CEO and founder had this I don't know if you saw it, Stu, 4-point tests. The Department of Defense has to be asking for it as a requirement or a problem. Congress has to buy into it. I think nobody else can do it better. And just immediately think, you know, like, yeah, but what happens when the military, for some reason, is imagining a battle and a war that is not what's happening today, not what's going to happen in the future? And then you have that kind of going back to the urban warfare is the present. It is the future. It is the challenge. It is strategic down to tactical. And it ripples across to include R&D. And I've seen that, you know, whether it's Project Metropolis test with the U.S. Marine Corps, just taking very simple equipment and shoving it into even an urban warfare training site, let alone going to a toot with a real urban area. Although I know the British and the Army has a research lab that have done some urban warfare experimentation. You're right. If you go to like the primes and like the foundational equipment, it is rarely tested or applicable to the urban terrain, which is a much larger conversation. Okay, great job, both of you, on keeping it small. I don't know if I did or not, but I'm the godfather, so I'm going to take some liberty with that. Jason, you said two like 100 times, so I can make that reference to nudge at you a little bit. I really appreciate both of your time, and I hope our wishes come true and that we don't have to 5 years later come back and say it again and keep adding it to the list. And it's always great to hear from you guys.
That's great. Thanks very much, John.
Yeah, thanks, John. You know, this is our fourth Christmas Wishlist podcast. And if you total up all the wishes from all four of them, that's 33 wishes. And not all of them have been actioned or hardly any of them have actioned. So anyway, I hope we can start reducing these numbers and seeing some of our wishes come true. So thanks, John, for having us.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks for the numbers. Although I will say the one with the urban warfare school turning into the urban operations planner course was amazing feedback, and it does matter. Happy holidays to both of you, and I'll talk to you soon.
You too, John.
Merry Christmas. Thanks, John.
Thanks for listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast. The podcast is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of their participants and do not represent the positions of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. You can subscribe to the Urban Warfare Project podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. And be sure to check out NDY's other podcasts, as well as the new articles we're publishing every day on our website. Thanks again for listening.